Throughout my career, I worked at suppressing both my opinions and my emotions. I was out on the streets of New York on 9/11 and held myself together. I walked the alleys of Sadr City and once raced to a cafe in Tel Aviv minutes after it was leveled by a suicide bomber without allowing my fears to surface. I've asked embarrassing questions without embarrassment. And I've sat opposite mothers of dying children, teenagers who had been abused, and grown men and women who had suffered the indignities of injustice without breaking down in tears or exploding in outrage. I thought I had become the epitome of self-control. Then, wham! My first grandchild, Jordan, was born on January 30th, 2011. I was jolted, blindsided by a wallop of loving more intense than anything I could remember or had ever imagined. At the very same time, my mother, Dolly, was dying. It was a disconcerting conjunction, to say the least. Although she had spent the last 45 years complaining of one illness after the next, it was now for real. She might not live long enough to hold her great-grandchild. In no time, my diligently buried emotions burst out like kettle steam. Dolly had fallen and broken her hip, which set off her rapid decline. My husband Aaron and I were with her at the hospital when our daughter, Taylor, called from Los Angeles. All she said was, "They started." Aaron and I kissed my mother goodbye, assuring her we would call as soon as we knew anything. We drove to her house for our clothes and on to Logan Airport to catch the next plane to LAX. Our only child was in labor, 4 days early. On the plane, I fought off waves of fear. Would the baby be healthy? If something went wrong, would Taylor have to give up her career? For months, I've been pushing away such thoughts, those grandma gremlins. At the same time, I reproached myself for leaving Dolly. Would she be okay till I got back? We hadn't had the kind of even-keeled relationship I have with Taylor. When Dolly turned 93 a few months before, I told her I never thought she'd live that long. And she said, "Well, you don't have to say it so regretfully, you know." Her dig, meant to be funny, was a reminder of the old rancor between us. As we both aged and mellowed, we became friends. Now it pained me to leave her like that in the hands of nurses at the hospital. When we landed, Taylor was back home. She had gone to the hospital too early, and now she and our son-in-law, Andrew Major, were graphing her contractions on an iPad. I was sailing out of body. I couldn't believe it. My baby having a baby. How could this be? She was my special Taylor, calm and imperturbable as always. She was signaling that's what she needed from me. I would have to quiet my nervous excitement. At 5 the next morning, Taylor and Andrew raced back to Cedars-Sinai Medical Center. By the time Aaron and I got there, Taylor was already in a birthing room, which was spacious and light with a panoramic view of the Hollywood Hills. And yes, we could see the sign. Monitoring tubes dangled. A nurse bustled about. Taylor had already been given an epidural, so we would have no Murphy Brown wailing, though I doubt Taylor would have wailed even if she'd gone without. Histrionics are simply not on her emotional keyboard. She seems to have been born with something called hyperthymia. Roughly translated, it means perpetual happiness. I have a daughter who didn't go through the usual teenage miseries or years of hating her mother. I confess to both. We had no melodrama. Doors weren't slammed. She was so even-tempered as a child, I worried. "It's just not normal," I told Aaron. "She must be repressing. Her head'll blow off one day. She needs to see a child psychiatrist." "What'll you tell him?" he asked. "My daughter suffers from being too happy? Are you kidding?" Eventually, I talked to a shrink myself, who assured me there really are people out there, including teenage girls, who are never moody. Imagine.